WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Comedy Central begins a five-part series on the heroes of black comedy next week. On today's Fresh Air, we feature highlights of our interviews with Bill Cosby, Richard Pryor, Chris Rock, Damon Wayans, Bernie Mac, and David Alan Greer. And we'll hear some classic comedy routines. Also, TV critic David Bianculli previews African Americans in Television, which airs tonight on the cable network TV Land. And book critic Maureen Corrigan has an appreciation of Pippi Longstocking, the children's book character created by Swedish author Astrid Lindgren. She died this week at the age of 94. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. There are conflicting reports about the fate of kidnapped journalist Daniel Pearl. Police in Pakistan say a telephone call to the U.S. consulate in Karachi demanded $2 million in ransom for the release of the Wall Street Journal reporter. At the same time, though, CNN said it had received an email saying that Pearl had been killed by his captor. Neither version of the story has been confirmed. The telephone caller reportedly also demanded the release of the former Taliban ambassador to Pakistan, who was arrested in Pakistan and turned over to U.S. authorities. The anonymous caller gave the U.S. government 36 hours to meet the demands. In a move widely seen as a response to the Enron collapse, President Bush outlined proposals to reform pension laws and give workers greater flexibility to diversify their retirement holdings. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
The president proposed requiring quarterly information for workers regarding their retirement investments. He wants new restrictions on so-called blackout periods during which employees can't sell stock. And he'd mandate that employers allow workers to sell company stock in their retirement plans after 3 years. All these issues figured in the outrage over the collapse of Enron, where workers complained they were not told about the company's problems and were blocked from selling their stock during a blackout period. The Bush reforms would not place a cap on the amount of company stock a worker can choose to hold in a retirement fund. Another prominent proposal in Congress would limit the amount of anyone's stock in a 401k to 20% and reduce tax breaks to companies that offer stock instead of cash to match workers' 401k contributions. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Bail has been set at $1 million each for two former members of the Symbionese Liberation Army. Emily Montague and Bill Harris are accused of murder during a Sacramento bank robbery in 1975. NPR's John McChesney reports.
In a Sacramento, California courtroom packed with media and friends and supporters of the two accused, Judge Tani Kantil Sukayu said she didn't think Emily Montague, formerly Emily Harris, or Bill Harris would flee, given their middle-class professional and family commitments. But the seriousness of their alleged crime, she said, required that she set bail at the $1 million called for by prosecutors. Lawyers for the two had asked that bail be set at nearly one-quarter that amount, saying that that was all the equity family and friends could raise now. The two appeared in court in civilian suits, looking like the middle-class members they have become since the 1970s. Several witnesses testified about their love of family and community commitments, but prosecutors argued that in the 1970s, Montague and Harris would have issued death warrants for people like themselves. John McChesney, NPR News, Sacramento, California.
In stocks today, the Dow lost 12 points to close at 9,907. The Nasdaq lost 23 points, more than 1%. This is NPR News. Boxer Mike Tyson has asked the California State Athletic Commission to grant him a license to fight. Tyson was turned down last week by the Nevada Athletic Commission after discussion about his alleged violent behavior at an event in New York to promote a fight with heavyweight champion Lennox Lewis. The NCAA punished the University of Alabama football program today for rule violations, including big payments from wealthy boosters to recruit promising players. NPR's Debbie Elliott reports.
In what officials call one of the most serious infractions cases ever, the NCAA put the University of Alabama football program on 5 years probation banned the team from playing in postseason bowl games for 2 years and took away 21 scholarships. It was the third time in 6 years that the NCAA has found major rule violations at Alabama. The Infractions Committee chair said the university's cooperation and self-investigation saved it from the most severe punishment, the elimination of the storied Crimson Tide football program. Among other violations, the NCAA found that school boosters had offered payments ranging from $20,000 to $110,000 to lure two high school football stars to Alabama. University officials say they will appeal. Debbie Elliott, NPR News.
The Argentine Supreme Court ruled today that it's unconstitutional for the government to freeze citizens' savings accounts and limit the amount of cash people can withdraw from banks. The banking restrictions were put in place in early December to prevent the banking system collapse that would result if people withdrew all their savings. The banking restrictions triggered widespread and violent demonstrations leading to the fall of the elected government. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from PBS, presenting Now with Bill Moyers, a new weekly series produced in collaboration with NPR News, Friday nights at 9 on PBS stations. Local times may vary.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The start of Black History Month has triggered several ambitious TV productions, including two documentary miniseries looking at specific aspects of mass entertainment. The cable network TV Land begins its three-part African Americans in Television special tonight, and Comedy Central begins its five-part Heroes of Black Comedy series on Monday. Later in the show, we'll feature interviews with some of those heroes. First, TV critic David Bianculli has this review.
Both of these specials came about because specific cable networks, with very specific identities, began to plan ahead for Black History Month and wonder what they could do. Comedy Central decided to profile some of the most influential black comics, and TV Land decided to take on the very complex subject of African Americans on television. As a result, we have two very entertaining specials this month that add to the history while recalling it. Because both Comedy Central and TV Land are basic ad-supported cable networks, they don't enjoy the freedom of language of an HBO or Showtime. So in both these documentaries, when it comes to segments on modern stand-up comedy, there's a certain amount of censorship, a few bleeped words here and there. Sometimes more than a few. It happens in Monday's opening Heroes of Black Comedy show devoted to Chris Rock. And it happens not only when Rock is doing his breakout stand-up act on HBO, the one in which he did a now-famous routine comparing, in his words, blacks and niggers, but when people like Bill Maher of Politically Incorrect try to quote Chris Rock.
It's easy for a black comic to challenge the white audience. Even the white people are going to applaud it. Yes, we're bad, we know. We brought you over here as slaves, and we've kept you down. Of course that's true. White people feel guilty. It's no trick to challenge a white audience. The reason why he's a great comedian and a great artist is because he challenges the black audience. Because as he, I think I'm quoting him correctly when he says, art is raggedy too.
And I see some black people looking at me, man, why you gotta say that? Why you gotta say that? It ain't us, it's the media. It ain't us, it's the media. The media has distorted our image to make us look bad. Why must you come down on us like that, brother? It ain't us, it's the media. Please cut them. Okay.
But even with a few censored words, Heroes of Black Comedy gets its points across easily. And over on TV Land, an even more ambitious documentary series does an even better job. African Americans in Television is divided into 3 one-hour segments, each devoted to a prominent TV genre. The installment titled Variety launches the Inside TV Land series tonight. Drama follows 2 weeks later, and comedy concludes the series at the end of February. Tonight's opener, on Variety, begins by putting both early TV and the struggling civil rights movement in proper developmental context. It's sufficiently informed and patient to note some generally forgotten pioneers, like The Billy Daniels Show, a 1952 variety series headlined by that black entertainer that lasted only 13 weeks on ABC. This TV Land Hour also covers the controversial NBC Petula Clark special in 1968. When there was objection to the way the singer held guest Harry Belafonte's arm during a song. We not only see the clip in question, but hear from Clark and Belafonte today, as well as the opinion of showbiz veteran Quincy Jones.
I wanted a guest, obviously, and they said to me, well, who would you like? And I said, well, Harry Belafonte.
Blessed are the meek, they say, they shall win where others lose.
For her very first show, to have wanted to share it with me as her co-star was for me at that time in the American history a very remarkable move on her part.
Clark and Belafonte performed an anti-war song called Paths of Glory.
Red or yellow, white or brown, all alike, one thought in mind.
And of course, because it's a very, very emotional song, I just took hold of his arm as a natural thing.
Petula Clark put her hand on Belafonte's arm or whatever, and it was a big deal. Please.
An executive at the show's sponsor, Plymouth, saw the taping and objected to Clark's physical contact with Belafonte.
I didn't get it. I just didn't understand what was going on.
Fearing negative reactions in the South, Plymouth threatened to pull their sponsorship unless the offending scene was cut. But Clark and her producers refused to reshoot the show.
She wasn't even doing me a favor or doing the race a favor. She was just looking at the way it should be.
When the story was picked up in the press, Plymouth issued a public apology.
The little man who was representing Plymouth Motor Cars at the time, he lost his job.
The special aired uncut.
Criticisms of both these series are minor. With the Comedy Central specials, I would have liked to have seen more clips. When they talk about Chris Rock's 3-year stint on Saturday Night Live, for example, we don't see a single sample. And on TV Land Show, the installment on comedy doesn't give enough credit to the feisty independence of Eddie Rochester Anderson's valet on the Jack Benny program, or the dignified diversity among the background characters on Amos and Andy. Otherwise, TV Land gets so much so right that it's a delight and almost unfair to nitpick. Frank's Place gets its due, finally, and In Living Color, and even such latecomers as My Wife and Kids. Both TV Land and Comedy Central are more used to goofing around and acting ironic than taking themselves and their subjects seriously. These documentaries are very welcome exceptions, and I hope they make their respective networks think about doing similarly impressive specials on other thoughtful topics. A Comedy Central documentary on the history of stand-up? A TV Land special on sex on TV? Or on the family sitcom over the years? Why not? Even a network named Comedy Central doesn't have to make you laugh all the time.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Comedy Central's Heroes of Black Comedy series begins Monday. We're going to listen back to interviews with great African-American comics, starting with the two most influential ones to emerge in the 60s, Richard Pryor and Bill Cosby. Here's one of Cosby's early recordings.
No, I love doctors, but there's only one thing, two things I've found fault with. I can find fault with the doctors. One, you could have a busted leg. Your leg could be hanging out, and the guy will still want to feel it. You know, let me feel it. Does that hurt? Hey! Yeah, does that hurt? Does that hurt? And they always keep the stethoscope in the freezer. I warm that thing up with my hands. Whenever I go to see my doctor, I grab a stethoscope. I pull it right out of the refrigerator, and I start warming it up with my hands. And they put that cold thing on you, and they say, take a deep breath. Oh! You can't help but take a deep breath. The problem is trying to breathe out now.
What was the step for you right before you started performing? You know, what was it that made you realize, well, I could probably do this?
I was always dabbling. And people would say, you know, you're funny. You ought to be on the Ed Sullivan Show. And my answer to them was, right, just walk right up. I think a part of what kept me from really taking it seriously was because you're looking at the 50s and the 60s, and you're looking at no Negroes wanted here. I think the commitment came when I had all of my academic world set, my athletic world set, and then this show business world. I could toy around with that and not be super, super serious about entering the area. So while at college, I played 3 sports, was on the dean's list, and then in the evenings to supplement my mother's and father's checks, I took a job as a bartender at a place called the Cellar Bar. It was Broad and Spruce, I think it was. Mixing drinks, I would tell the customers, we would trade jokes, really, and I'd get tips from that. It was a white Englishman and his white wife, who was English also, became regular customers. And then one day he said, I was telling a fellow at a club called the Gaslight in Greenwich Village about you, and he wants to give you a job as a comedian. And so I said, okay, thank you.
So that's where it started for you, in the Village?
Absolutely. When I went in, the job description was fantastic. The guy said to me, I need somebody to break up the monotony of the folk singers. So that freed me up right away. I mean, so, you know, after these people sing about the wind called Mariah and the Dust Bowl and going fishing, et cetera, and the falsetto voices, and after they stood there tuning up, I could never understand why folk singers didn't tune up in the back and then come out front. They always came out and stood there for a good 10 minutes tuning up in front of the audience. So when the folk singer would come off, and my job actually was to introduce the next folk singer, I had 10 to 15 minutes.
So you did really well as a comic and eventually ended up acting. I think your first real acting job was co-starring on the TV series I Spy, where you were an undercover agent playing with Robert Culp. This was the first dramatic series to star a black actor, I Spy, the first non-comedy series. You wanted to know about the script before you would sign on. What kinds of things did you want to know?
I wanted to know how they were going to treat the Negro. I certainly was not going to be a black joke. And I certainly was not going to be afraid of ghosts. But let me tell you that the fellows, the writers, David Friedkin and Mort Fine, along with Sheldon, I never had a problem with them at all. If anything, they made Alexander Scott a super, super, super hero. Guy was a Rhodes Scholar, spoke seven languages, et cetera, et cetera.
Bill Cosby recorded in 1991 an interview with Richard Pryor after a break. This is Fresh Air. Richard Pryor started his career by imitating Bill Cosby, but soon realized there was a world of junkies, hustlers, friends, and family screaming inside his head, trying to be heard. His comedy was filled with his perceptions about being African-American.
Have any of you ever been to Africa, back to the motherland? That's something. And I went to Zimbabwe. It's a new country, right? It's about 3 years old now, because it used to be Rhodesia before they killed all them white motherfuckers over. It's the only country I've ever been to. Black people kicked ass over there. 7 years, they killed my Jack. They happy, too. You walk down the street, they just smiling.
Hello. Oh, they don't with us no more, no.
No, it's just a nice feeling. I know how white people feel in America now. Relaxed. Because when I heard the police car, I knew they wasn't coming after me. You know, I just... busy. I'm just laying busy. Must be going after some white person. But over here, man, you hear a police car, I don't give a how sleepy you are. You will wake your ass up if you're black. You start thinking about what you did.
Well, they can't get me for that. Well, I didn't do that. And I'll go back to sleep.
And you can be asleep at night, man, and you hear, like, the warriors come in from, like, the village people, people who live in the country. You hear them singing and shit. My wagon, that way, well. You've been in a hotel, and you say, what's that? Get my wagon, the wagon. Come on, my wagon, there's something to see. Come on, my wagon,
I'm a graduate. Boom. Tell my job, job. Boom.
That'd be beautiful, man. And white people start asking you questions then. What are they saying? What are they talking about? What's going on? Rich, you got any idea? What are they doing? There's 100 of them. What are they planning? Anything?
Richard Pryor's performing career was ended by multiple sclerosis, which was first diagnosed in 1986. When I spoke with him in 1995, he told me that he spent periods in bed where he couldn't move his arms or legs.
What did you do to pass the time while you were in bed and couldn't move?
Good question. I'm trying to think, what did I do? Oh, I remember I smoked some bass. No, I did.
Did you really, or are you?
No, I'm serious. And my ex-wife, Flynn, came to visit me. And she walked through my stuff, and she found it. And she said, what is this? I had a rock, you know. She said, what's this? And I didn't tell her, because I was scared. And she said, is this dope? I said, nah. I said, just looks like it, but that's not really. And she threw it out.
So have you stopped?
Yes.
Was there a turning point that got you to stop?
Yes. Well, it's called being broke.
Now, let me ask you an odd question. I mean, about freebasing. It's bad for your health, right? But, I mean, your health isn't good anyway. So would it being bad for your health not be likely to inspire you to stop? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. You're making sense. Is what you're saying. And if I was that type of person that made sense, I wouldn't be where I am. Because I never made no sense. You know, it was like, life to me was like, not supposed to make sense. Because, hey, it's, I don't care how you slice it, you ain't getting out alive. So enjoy as much as you can.
You are so important to so many people. I mean, so many people have, like, looked up to you for so long. Do you feel that you have to try to handle your illness now as, like, a role model? Do you know what I mean? Like, when you're a public person like yourself and people are looking at you, do you feel like... Yeah, that you need to do it like a role model. Not that you've been a traditional role model to anybody in the past.
Yeah. Hey, God gave me this. And I'm going to say this truthfully. God gave me just a little bit of it, you know? He said, so slow down for a minute. Take a break. You know, take a break and look at things differently. So I do. Rich is not a bad person. And this disease is just a disease. And I have it. So that's what I deal with.
Do you ever listen to your own records or watch your own films?
No. But I have them. I have them. No, I don't listen to them. I keep trying to get a friend of mine to listen to this Lenny Bruce record I have. and Lenny Bruce, oh, it was something he did on his album. God, I can't think of it. Come on, Richard. That's what happens. Your brain goes like that, mm-hmm. and it washes away everything you were thinking about. And people stop paying attention to you, you know? You go, I had it.
Now, is that a result of the illness, or is that just the kind of memory lapse that I have every day?
I don't know. I don't know your memory.
It's bad.
Well.
Really bad.
Well, but it's great to have one.
I mean,
if it is bad.
Yeah. Well, has the illness affected your memory is what I'm asking, I guess.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes. Because I remember things, and then I get ready to talk about them, and I forget them.
Mm-hmm. I know you keep a gun next to your bed.
Yeah.
What for?
Because the boogeyman might come in some night.
Who are you expecting?
The boogeyman. I mean, come on. There's such terrible things going on in the world. People are crazy. You know, that place in, where was it? In Oklahoma. That's crazy. That's different than anything I ever knew about America. It's like not America, you know? They're serious about whatever craziness it is. And I don't want to be caught in no trap and not be able to get off one shot.
I mean, excuse me for asking this, but would you be able to even use the gun if you had cause to?
No. I think the hard thing I do is having to cock it. Because it's a 9mm, and the bolt is real hard for me.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll say, wait a minute, please. Just a minute.
Right, help me out here.
I'll be with you in a minute. Yeah.
So, but really, what's the point of keeping it then if you can't even use it? Isn't it, like, more dangerous to you to have it there?
No. Mm-hmm. No danger. I did my best at the suicide. That's over with. God gives you one chance, and he says, well, you didn't make it, so now you got to do this. So I'm here.
I didn't mean to imply you were leaving it there for suicide.
Good.
Oh, gosh. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
Richard Pryor recorded in 1995. More great comics in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Lay That Trumpet in Our Hands by Susan Carol McCarthy, a novel set in Florida during the Civil Rights Movement. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, more comedy. We hear from David Alan Greer, Damon Wayans, Bernie Mac, and Chris Rock. And Maureen Corrigan has an appreciation of the children's book heroine Pippi Longstocking. Her creator, Astrid Lindgren, died this week.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Monday night, Comedy Central begins a 5-part series on the heroes of black comedy. We're listening back to interviews from our archives with great African-American comics. Actor and comic David Alan Greer got his start on the sketch comedy show In Living Color, which also featured the Wayans family and Jim Carrey. I spoke with Greer in 1991.
Now, a character you've done a lot is an old blues singer, an old blind blues singer, or is he really blind?
Right. Calhoun Tubbs. Calhoun Tubbs is like the worst blues singer in the world.
Thank you very much. All right. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Calhoun Tubbs, known to my friends as Hard Fingers. See, that's because back in 1947, I once played the guitar for over 36 hours straight. For no reason at all. That's right. I wrote a song about it. Like the kid, here go. I play guitar for 36 hours. Thank you very much. You know, I'd like to welcome y'all to my 75th anniversary show. That's right. 75 years in the business of the blues. Still trying to make it. I wrote a song about it, like the kid did go. 75 years of shopping days, and I'm still trying to make it.
I was doing a movie in Canada, and my wife and I, we went to this little bar, and I said, wow, you know, this old blues guy is there. And there are all these white people who are packed in this little coffee house, and this guy had to be the worst. He couldn't play guitar. He couldn't sing. You know, his songs were terrible. And yet there are all these kids, you know, like all these college students were packed around him like he was a messiah, you know, like this guy was a... was
authentic.
A real blues singer, and we were in the back laughing our heads off, man. So that was the idea for Calhoun Tubbs, this guy who's really terrible, a terrible blues singer, but he's got a lot of heart.
David Alan Greer recorded in 1991. He worked with the Wayans family in the sketch comedy show In Living Color and appeared in the Kenan Ivory Wayans movie I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka, a parody of black action films. Wayans played a young man who returns home from the army and learns his brother is dead.
Mom, exactly how did Junebug die? Mom.
She's really taking this pretty hard.
Well, is somebody gonna tell me what's going on?
Jack, not too long after you left, Junebug started hanging out with a bad crowd. I mean, he even started selling drugs, Jack. And then things really got bad when he...
Well, what?
He started wearing gold chains, Jack.
Oh, God, no.
It started out as just one or two. And it seemed like every time he'd get some money, he'd go and buy more gold chains. I mean, he was wearing hundreds of them, Jack, hundreds.
Not gold.
Yes, Jack, gold chains and medallions and rings and even his teeth, Jack. You couldn't imagine what it was like to kiss him. He took a picture just before he died. We put it on the mantle.
Junebug! How do you go to the bathroom with all this stuff on?
Damon Wayans had a small part in his brother's film, I'm Gonna Get You, Sucka. Damon Wayans has since starred in many movies, as well as his own sitcom, My Wife and Kids. I spoke with him in 1999 after the publication of his book, Bootleg, which included excerpts of his routines. Our interview started with a reading.
Mo' Money. I found out one of my partners, Larry, is in jail now. He got 25 years for something he didn't do. He didn't run fast enough. I always knew this brother was going to jail because he was one of them dudes that wanted to make it in life, but he wanted to get over. He was a con artist, always had a plan. I called him the street businessman. I saw him when he got out of jail the last time. He's like, what up, D? Yo, it's good to see you, man. I heard you was out there in California, man. You're doing comedy now, right? You funny? Go ahead, say something funny. Oh, man, you need an audience and whatnot and lights. Yeah. Look, you keep doing it, man. You about to be like the next Bugs Bunny or something. Yeah, but I ain't got time for no Three Stooges-type silliness. I'm trying to get me some income coming in. Word. Yo, this is what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna get me a full-time job at McDonald's. Then I'm gonna work my way up to manager. Then I'm gonna let my boys come rob the place. More money. See, I take that stolen money and I throw it in the bank. I won't touch that. I step off, you know, let interest handle that, you know. And it'll be like, boom, more money. See, I'm going to do this like every other day so they don't catch on. Because I don't want to go to McJail or nothing. You know, I'll be in that cell with the Hamburglar. He be bugging me out with that head, you know. Yo, and then clock this. I'ma let my lady forge checks, right? Cause she works in the bank. And then I'ma let her prostitute on the side. You know, just in case the bank thing don't work out, she got something to fall back on. Now, this is only part-time, see? Cause, yo, I can't have no full-time hoe living in my house. I'm just that type of dude. See, then dig this. I'm gonna adopt me a kid. One of them little foster kids, right? Cause they pay you to take their ass, right? And I'm gonna let him sell joints in school. More money, more money. See, this is good for the kid too, cause it teaches him responsibility, right? Cause if he messes my money, I'ma hurt him. Now, I figure every day before he goes to school, I throw 100 lunch joints up in his lunchbox. Get him one of them Fred Flintstone lunchboxes, you know, cause kids, they need that type of thing, you know? And then I send him out the door. Boom, go make that money, son. Now, if he get busted, I come to school, play the father role. Yo, what's up, teacher? No, no, tell me what happened. I don't want to know your name. I don't want to shake your hand. I just want the facts. Forget that. Forget all that, you know, parental stuff. Now tell me, what was my little white son doing? Then I play all surprised and be like, oh, snap, he was doing what? Ooh, surprise, surprise. And then since this is a teacher, right, I start throwing big words on him. I be like, circumcise me. No, flatulate the information because the whole constipation got my scrotum detached. No, no, no. Let me shed my foreskin on the issue. You retain your liquids while I masturbate my embryonic fluids. So this whole thing is supercalifragilisticexpialidocious. See, now when the teachers see how smart I am, they'll probably put me in charge of the PTA. Then I start selling crack to the parents. More money, more money, more money.
That's Damon Wayans, and that's an excerpt of his new book, Bootleg. Damon Wayans, you break me up. That is so great. Now, that's really comes out of a sketch that you did on In Living Color. Then there was the Mo Money movie. Tell me how you first came up with the idea of that character and the Mo Money idea.
That was actually a friend of mine named Larry. He's actually no longer with us. But he was actually this guy who always had this master plan, how he was going to make money and, you know, and get over in life. And I found him very funny.
What were his real schemes? Were they what you were saying?
He was selling drugs out of his mother's house. And he actually died because they came to kill his mother. And he said, kill me first. And they did.
Gee. How did you know him?
I grew up with him. He was my my buddy. We used to hang out and get into trouble together.
Did your parents worry that you were going to head in this direction if you kept hanging out with that kind of crowd?
All the time. All the time, my mother would tell me, you need to be more like Kenan. Because Kenan was like the guy who didn't get in any trouble, ever. He always was a straight-A student, and, you know, the only thing he did was wear kung fu shoes in the winter. You know, that was his only, you know, vice was he was into karate.
Now, you had a club foot when you were growing up, so you knew what it was like to have a handicap and probably to be mocked for it.
Oh, yeah. I got all my best fights came from people talking about my shoe. That was my weak spot. And, you know, we used to play this game called the Dozens.
Mm-hmm.
And people really didn't like playing with me because once they talked about my shoe, it was over. You know, we'd start out very friendly, you know, very kind of surface. You know, your mother wears combat boots. Yeah, well, your father is so poor he can't pay attention. Yeah, well, your sister is so ugly he got a top pork chop on her neck so the dog will play with her. Yeah, well, your mother is so black. When she goes to night school, they mark her absent. And then they go for the shoe. Yeah, so what about the crippled people shoes you be wearing? What about that, huh? Okay. Oh, so you want to get real now, huh? Alrighty then. What about when your father left your mother with 6 kids? That's why 2 of your sisters have illegitimate children because there's no one there to guide them. That's why one of your brothers is a junkie, the other one is homosexual. That's why your sister outside prostituting because she can't afford to feed y'all. That's why every time welfare come over, y'all got to hide over my house because you kind of get 2 welfare check when you're supposed to get 1. Your turn.
So what did that shoe look like?
Like the Forrest Gump shoe. Remember Forrest Gump when he had that big shoe, the brace that went up to the knee? And it squeaked. That was the worst part of that shoe. The brace would make this noise. And you couldn't hide it. You know, I'm standing there talking to a girl, and this shoe go, what's that noise? That's my shoe. It needs some oil.
Dib and Wayans recorded in 1999. Bernie Mac and Chris Rock, after a break, this is Fresh Air. Bernie Mac became well-known through Spike Lee's performance film, The Original Kings of Comedy. Now he's starring in a hit sitcom, The Bernie Mac Show. In the first episode, Mac and his wife take in his sister's three young children because his sister has a drug problem and is in rehab. In this scene, Bernie Mac talks directly to the audience about his new situation.
America, let's talk.
Yeah, my sister's on drugs. That's okay. Some of your family members messed up, too. What am I supposed to do? Allow these three kids to go to the state or some foster home or some white couple. Hold on. This ain't about race. It's not about race. I just don't want to hear them talking all property like that. You know what I'm saying? That's all I'm trying to say. Or they got to sit there and share food with 40 other kids. No, that ain't right. I'm trying to do the right thing.
You grew up on the south side of Chicago.
Yes, ma'am.
Describe where you grew up.
I grew up, I was born on 66 and Blackstone. That building was torn down because it was rat infested. We couldn't play outside because the rats used to be in the walls on the banisters. We stayed on the third floor, and my mom used to literally pick me up. I was 3 to 4 years old, and she would walk me three flights of stairs and kicking rats from my feet. The city tore the building down and moved us to 69th and Morgan. Well, that was a little bit better, supposedly, the Inglewood area in Chicago. And at 4 years old, that's when I, 4 to 5, decided I wanted to be a comedian because I walked in from playing and I saw my mother sitting in her favorite chair crying. And as a little kid, I saw her cry and I began to cry, like most kids often do. And I asked her why was she crying and she told me nothing. At that particular time, Ed Sullivan was introducing Bill Cosby. Bill Cosby came out and he did a routine about rats and snakes in the bathroom. My mother began to laugh and cry at the same time. When I saw that, I started laughing with her. And I told my mom, I said, that's what I'm going to be, Mom. I'm going to be a comedian. So I'll never have to see you cry again. Because at that particular time, I thought comedians relieve my mother of her pain. And that's something that I always wanted to do.
Now, when you were getting started, did you play different kinds of audiences, some black audiences, some white audiences, some integrated audiences?
I performed whatever there was people. I started on the L's of Chicago. In the 70s, I used to ride the L's and perform from 95th Street all the way downtown. I used to do the subways. I made $300 to $400 a day.
Wow, that's great.
But I was
probably more
happy
than some of the comedy cups played.
Yeah, but I wasn't happy.
I
wasn't happy at all because I felt like I was begging. I felt like a bum.
Right.
I wanted to be legitimized. In 1977, I went to the clubs.
Did you find that white audiences and black audiences reacted differently to your material or reacted differently in general?
Well, they act different in general because white audience come to be entertained. Black audience want to entertain you. And white audience are more cordial, more respectful of the artist. And even if you're bad, I mean, you know, the audience has changed. I'm talking about the audience back then.
Mm-hmm.
The audience has changed all the way around the table now. But white audience was more cordial to you. Black audience, they just tell you like it is. If you suck, you suck. And they don't want to hear you. You ain't getting nothing but 2 or 3 minutes. You come out the gate with that old sorry stuff, you're in a world of trouble.
Well, how would you get driven off the stage if you weren't working?
I refuse to get driven off the stage.
Okay.
When I died the death of a pilot, I stayed up there. And that was something I think that helped me to this day.
Bernie Mac recorded last fall. Chris Rock started his comedy career on Saturday Night Live, has since been in many films, and has hosted his own HBO show. Like many great comics, he can be very politically incorrect. When I spoke with him in 1997, we played an excerpt of his bit about Marion Barry, the former mayor of Washington, D.C., who had been convicted in 1990 for cocaine possession.
How the hell Marion Barry get his job back? Smoke crack got his job back. How the hell that happened? I mean, if you get caught smoking crack at McDonald's, you can't get your job back. That's right. They're not gonna trust you around the Happy Meals. Send your ass to Hardee's. Smoke crack got his job. But all I want to know, who ran against him that they lost? Who was so bad they lost to a crackhead? What was their campaign like? What was they on heroin? Man, come on, man. How are they going to tell little kids to not get high when the mayor's on crack? Don't get high, you won't be nothing. I can be mayor.
Now, I have a question about your voice. Your voice in your onstage performances, in when you're doing comedy, is much deeper, louder, and rougher than your voice in conversation, which is higher and lighter.
Right.
Almost sweeter, if I could use that word.
Oh, thanks.
And I almost feel like, are you not comfortable with that voice on stage? Do you feel like you need a harder-edged voice to do your comedy?
Well, you know, it's the money's on the line. It's like people are paying $25. They want a performance. They don't want me. They want me to be better than me. I got to look better than me. I got to be taller, louder, funny. I have to be more. So, I mean, when you're on stage, it's kind of like being a woman, you know? It's like, put on the makeup, do the hair. You know, nobody wants me. They want Chris Rock. I'm just Chris.
So you got to put on a personality on stage.
Well, I got to be bigger than I normally am. I mean, at the same token, I couldn't walk through life acting the way I act on stage.
Well, right, without getting hit a lot, probably.
Right, exactly.
No, I meant to ask you, did you go to the Million Man March? You talk about it a little bit in your routine. Were you there?
You know what? I didn't go.
How come?
I should have went.
Did you think about it? Was it a decision to go or not to go?
Now, you know, first of all, the decision, I mean, probably the main reason I didn't go because I'm famous and I just...
Right. I don't really like being in big crowds when you're famous.
I really don't feel like being in big crowds.
Yeah. Look, there's like, Chris Rock.
Yeah, but there are a lot of other famous people that are more famous than me.
I have one last question for you. It might be
really?
Yeah, what might seem strange to you. What did being really skinny, do you think, affect who you became and how people thought of you? Or, you know, how you see yourself as a comic? Were you kind of scrawny as a kid?
I'm scrawny now as a man. Totally. Being skinny has affected every aspect of my life. Every decision I make, everything I put on, put it this way, look at my stand-up. My stand-up, I have twice as many. I always say comedy, stand-up comedy and boxing are pretty much the same. You know, boxing is to sports what stand-up is to entertainment, because it's just a guy out there by himself. And I perform like a skinny boxer, where I don't have the ability to knock you out, so you take my hour special and anybody else's hour special. I probably have twice as many jokes compact in it. Because my size has me so insecure, I'm always working twice as hard. So, yeah, being skinny has totally affected me and totally, totally, totally weirded me out.
But speaking of boxing,
men are
did
crazy.
You, did people fight with you a lot when you were young and take advantage of your size?
Totally. Totally.
Did you?
And the only reason they don't do it now is because I'm me.
Right, you're famous.
That's the only reason.
Did you learn to fight?
When you're as small as I am, it doesn't really matter.
Try martial arts or anything?
Martial arts. Some big guy will just grab you and throw you down. What's the point?
Did you try to cripple your opponent with comedy?
I've just, stayed out of environments and situations where fights may occur. No drinking. Like, I don't drink because I can't fight. Whatever it is, alcohol served as a bouncer because people get out of hand. So I can't, too little to be around guys that get out of hand. So I can't drink. Poor, woe is me. I'm sure Woody and Spike think the same.
Right, right. Well, that's true, isn't it?
Yeah.
Oh, you can have him on your show and talk about it. A little self-help.
That's why I love Spike, Brooklyn and Skinny.
Chris Rock, recorded in 1997. He's the subject of the first installment of Comedy Central's five-part series, Heroes of Black Comedy. It will be shown on Monday. Coming up, Maureen Carrigan remembers the creator of Pippi Longstocking. This is Fresh Air. Award-winning author Astrid Lindgren, the creator of the beloved children's character Pippi Longstocking, died in Stockholm, Sweden this past Monday. Lindgren was 94. Her three books about the independent redhead with the vertical braids and the mismatched tights have spawned picture books, movies, cartoons, even a Swedish theme park. Most of all, though, Pippi has inspired generations of young readers to leap in the air and fly, at least in their imaginations. Book critic Maureen Carrigan has an appreciation.
One of the things I love most about the Pippi Longstocking books is the tale of their origins. Astrid Lindgren always said that Pippi Longstocking came into being in 1939 when her then 7-year-old daughter Karin was convalescing in bed from pneumonia. Karin asked her mother to tell her a story about a girl. Karin had even concocted a silly name for her, Pippi Longstocking. 3 years later, when Lindgren herself was laid up in bed with a leg injury, she wrote down the stories she'd been making up about Pippi. There's something enchanted, I think, about that image of a mother and daughter temporarily freed from the constraints of the world in the dreamy, drowsy space of a sick room. The mother is spinning out tales of a girl with wild clothes, superhuman strength, and a boundless sense of fun. The daughter is laying in bed, all ears, absorbing the anarchic possibilities. Now that I'm the mother myself of a little girl, I can also appreciate why Lindgren had to make those stories up for her daughter. Over 50 years after the first of the three Pippi books was published in Sweden in 1945, strong, impish female characters are still not nearly as populous as their male counterparts. Based on a completely random and tiny survey among both the little and the grown-up boys I know, I'd say the Pippi books constitute a rare example of a girl's adventure saga, one that boys can read without worrying that they're turning into sissies. First of all, Pippi is no girly girl. Instead, she's the mistress of misrule. She's always subverting traditional hierarchies, denying reality, and blurring the boundaries between truth and lies. Outfitted with a monkey, Mr. Nielsen, for a companion, and two socialized neighbor children, Tommy and Annika, as foils, Pippi roams the Swedish countryside, outwitting schoolteachers and policemen, beating up gangs of bullies and robbers, and lifting up horses and circus strongmen with a flick of her skinny arms. Pippi's ramshackle house, Villa Villa Coola, is the storm center of this cheerful chaos. Realizing every child's sporadic fantasy, Pippi lives there alone. Her sea captain father was washed overboard in a storm. Pippi tells everyone he's now a cannibal king. Her dead mother, she insists, is an angel. Every so often, Pippi looks up at the heavens and calls out her signature phrase to her mother. Don't you worry about me. I'll always come out on top. One thing Pippi clearly has in spades is that quality that's so tediously preached in contemporary children's stories, self-esteem. But Astrid Lindgren recognized that to preach was to condescend. So Pippi's deeds, much more than her words, give her young readers a sense of the self-sufficiency that comes from liking who you are. Lindgren also knew that sadness had to intrude into Pippi's world to give it depth. Every so often, Pippi's merry autonomy shades into loneliness. The last image Lindgren gives us of Pippi is an ambiguous one. Tommy and Annika are standing outside Villa Villa Coola on a winter's night, looking through the kitchen window at Pippi. They want to wave to her, but she doesn't look up. Pippi, Lindgren writes, was sitting at the table with her head propped against her arms. She was staring at the little flickering flame of a candle that was standing in front of her. She seemed to be dreaming. Like all the great rebel loners of children's literature, Peter Pan, Curious George, Peter Rabbit, Pippi touches everyone who meets her. But no one can, or ever will, touch her.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. I'm Terry Gross. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. On the next Fresh Air, a question, answer, and insult session with Gene Simmons, the tongue-wagging bassist of Kiss. He has a new best-selling memoir. Also, we meet Mark Webber, the young actor from the new Todd Solondz movie, Storytelling. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.